This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The worst pandemic in a century. Everybody running through that gauntlet of stress, trying to avoid the sickness. We will add stunning record fires along the west of North America, and a big helping of toxic smoke for much of the Northern Hemisphere during a breathing disease. There are at least 100 million newly unemployed people in the developed economies. In other places, hunger is back. Don't forget the transcontinental plague of grasshoppers this year and some weird, weird storms. Not enough excitement for you? How about so many storms and hurricanes we run out of names for them? I suppose we still have time for earthquakes and tidal waves to round out the package for the year. So you can be forgiven if you did not notice, Earth's poles are going through epoch-making changes these days. Disappearing ice isn't sexy, it isn't easy to show, nobody's out there looking at it. But if you like sci-fi future horror, rapidly disappearing ice at both poles has plenty of that. We have two polar ice experts reporting on their latest science. From the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado, you will hear Arctic scientist Laura Landrum. Her latest paper confirms, in 2020, the Arctic has reached a new climate state. You can't say that very often, a new climate state.
The whole polar ice cap's melting.
The Arctic is at the bleeding edge of rapid global warming. Landrum drills down to the sea ice which used to cover the entire Arctic Ocean. Satellites show that sea ice is currently 31% lower than it was in 1979. That changes the temperature of Arctic air, sea, and land, and it hurries the permafrost melt. It makes the pole rainier, and often at odd times of the year. She tells us about new research that at least 25% of current warming of the whole world comes from extra heat arriving from the sun into the Arctic Sea instead of being reflected back into space when the sea ice was there. Is 2020 setting an absolute record low for sea ice this September? Listen to find out. Another new study, published in the prestigious journal Nature, is titled Ice Sheet Losses Track High-End Sea Level Rise Projections. Uh-oh. Here we move on from floating sea ice to glaciers. They are falling faster into the sea and melting away, and it's happening at both poles. We will talk with the lead author of that study, Thomas Slater. He's a research fellow at the University of Leeds in the UK. Basically, while we are not there to see, polar glaciers are disappearing faster than even the worst-case scenarios. Yes, that is another proof the Arctic is warming faster than anywhere. Yes, that is another proof that climate change is real and it's coming too fast. It is something we can measure, icy hard facts becoming liquid and running away. The new water added to the ocean runs to every country with a sea coast. It goes up estuaries, eats away coastlines, and piles up in every hurricane, high tide, and storm. Slater agrees with NASA that in some cases, there is no way to stop these mountains of ice from becoming seawater now. This massive change has happened. The tipping point for a grand melting of the world's second biggest pile of ice, Greenland, that was 20 years ago. Like light from the stars, rising seas just takes a while to reach us.
President Obama promised to begin to slow the rise of the oceans. And to heal the planet. My promise is to help you and your family.
Also hot in the Ice House news is this. The Arctic's largest remaining ice shelf lost a very big chunk of ice, like the volume of mountains, has broken away in northeastern Greenland. Floating off into the Atlantic are new, melting ice islands twice the size of Manhattan. I won't try to pronounce the complicated Nordic name for that place. Scientists just call it 79N. According to satellite images, a portion of the shelf at 79N, about 110 square kilometers, that's 42 square miles of thick glacier, just shattered. It fell apart this summer. This follows absolute record-hot summers in the Arctic in 2019 and 2020. On top of the whole region warming around 3 degrees C since 1980. So the far north has already gone past the 3 degrees C of warming, way beyond the supposed safe line of 1.5 or even 2 degrees C, recommended by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and agreed to by most governments at the Paris Accord of 2015. We're past that. The Arctic is already soaring into dangerous warming, and the ice is responding at rates older scientists would never have believed possible. Then we have this from Chris Mooney at the Washington Post, September 14. Two major Antarctic glaciers are tearing loose from their restraints, scientists say. Pine Island and Thwaites glaciers already contribute 5% of sea level rise. End quote from Chris Mooney's headline. A couple of years ago, NASA said ice loss at the Thwaites Glacier was unstoppable. That glacier collects snow and ice from over 192,000 square kilometers, 74,000 square miles in West Antarctica. That is bigger than countries like Senegal, Syria, or Uruguay. The amount of sea level rise due to this one glacier, added to its increasing movement, means Thwaites is sometimes called the Doomsday Glacier. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to our Ice Doomsday Special. Let's go to our scientists for the latest.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
With 90-degree heat reported in the high Arctic in both Canada and Russia this summer, and sea ice near record lows, has the Arctic changed permanently into a new state? Because that could alter the weather in the entire northern hemisphere, where the majority of humans live, and raise sea levels beyond expectations. Sure enough, a new paper says extremes become routine in an emerging new Arctic. Has the far north already entered a new climate state, ahead of the rest of the world? Our guest is the lead author, Dr. Laura Landrum. She is a scientist from NCAR, the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. Laura Landrum, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The Arctic has been in a deep freeze during all of human evolution. Are you saying a new climate state is emerging there?
Yes, I am. I am indeed. This work shows how the Arctic is emerging. And it may continue to emerge into an even more different climate. But yes, it is emerging into a different climate regime than we've seen.
So how do you define what a new climate is for the Arctic?
So what we're looking at is this question of a new climate as being a climate when different aspects of the Arctic, and in our case, we looked at three different aspects, sea ice, air temperatures, and precipitation phase, so like a rainy day versus a snowy day when that precip falls as rain instead of snow. And our definition that we used in our paper for a new climate was when an aspect, when any of these parameters, if you will, is different enough from a previous climate that it's outside the bounds of previous fluctuations of the climate. So we compare it to a mean climate of the 1950s, a decade of climate then, and said when any of these aspects have changed enough from that climate that they are outside what was the natural variability or fluctuations during that time, it's in a new climate state.
How do you know the latest period of low sea ice and melting glaciers is not just part of a long natural cycle rather than a real change of state? Maybe it'll go back.
That's a very good question. One of the challenges in the Arctic is we have good observations, but our observations are limited in time. Sea ice, for example, we have observations during the satellite era, which began in 1979 and has continued through. And And we have good observations since 1979, and prior to that, we can make some estimates based on whaling ships and logs of sea captains and things like that. However, we don't have enough observations in time and space for sea ice to actually say statistically that the sea ice we have now is in a completely different climate. We do know that sea ice extents, we're probably within a week of the minimum sea ice extents for this year. The sea ice extents in the past 13 years have been the lowest of the entire satellite record. And that suggests that maybe we are. In other words, they are lower than any of the other previous fluctuations within that satellite era. And so we turn to climate models to try to address this question of when is the climate in a new state. And we used 249 simulations of climate from 1950 to 2100 from climate models that have all been validated against observations. In other words, these are models that scientists have shown do a very good job of reproducing observations. And from these, when you have 249 models or simulations, you can do statistics. You can calculate statistics that are quite robust. And from these simulations, we show that the statistics of sea ice were significantly different for the minimum sea ice in the 1990s compared to even the 1980s, and in particular compared to the 1950s. In other words, the average sea ice value in minimum sea ice in the 1990s fell outside of the fluctuations, almost all, not quite all, of the variability that was observed in that sea ice in the 1950s. So from these climate models, it's exactly what we've done, Alex, is we've looked at what is the natural variability or fluctuations of any of these parameters, and at what point in time do those aspects change such that they're no longer within the range of previous fluctuations. And we looked at fluctuations in the 1950s. So we don't compare it to, say, the last ice age or back in paleo time. We just compare it to the 20th century.
And last I heard, the lowest level of sea ice in the Arctic in September at the low point was in 2012. What is the condition of Arctic sea ice in this year of 2020?
We are not going to set the same record as 2012. 2012, you're right, was the lowest year on record during the satellite era. On the other hand, we are about 3.743 million square kilometers today, and by comparison, the low in the 2012, I think, was about 3.38 or so. I might have those numbers a little bit wrong, but anyways, we are coming close, and it looks like we are on track to set the second lowest on the record since 1979.
And how much has sea ice declined since the first satellites started measuring it in 1979?
So it has declined dramatically. Now, the Arctic's losing on average 12% of its summer sea ice per decade compared to that 1980 to 2010 mean. It's right now it's about 31% lower than the first decade, than the average of the first 10 years of the satellite era. We're about 31% lower.
So we lost a third of the Arctic sea ice in just the last few decades during the lifetime of our listeners.
Yes, we have.
Wow. So why do scientists focus so much attention on sea ice, perhaps at the expense of other factors like permafrost thaw? What is it about sea ice that seems important to you?
Well, sea ice has, and beyond the fact that I'm a polar scientist and a climate scientist, I study sea ice and climate, so of course I think it's important. I study a lot. But sea ice has lots of implications for climate, and there are feedback mechanisms that set in. When you have a warming climate and you have a reduction in sea ice, you further warm the climate just by melting sea ice. In the summer, for example, as you remove sea ice acts a little bit like a mirror, and it reflects radiation from the sun back out into the atmosphere and prevents it from getting to the Earth's surface and warming up the Earth's surface. It's highly reflective, and many people who have been on snow or ice know that. You know, you need more sunscreen when you're on snow if it's a sunny day, and it reflects that radiation back out. When you melt summer sea ice, you expose more of the underlying darker ocean, and that ocean then absorbs that heat and becomes warmer. It releases the heat back to the atmosphere in the fall as you get a change of season, and the atmosphere becomes warmer then, and it delays the freeze-up of the sea ice, making for a thinner sea ice in the following year. And in this way, the sea ice contributes to global warming, too. That melting of the sea ice, because it gets warmer, further warms the atmosphere. And, in fact, there's recent research that suggests that's between, I believe, 21 and 40% of Earth's warming is due to the melting of sea ice and snow and removal of that and that decrease in that reflective property, and the Earth is warming even more. Now, the sea ice also plays a role in the winter warming, in that in the winter, generally speaking, polar temperatures over the Arctic Ocean are colder than the ocean, which is above freezing. And sea ice acts like a blanket, and it's a thick blanket across up above that ocean. As it gets thinner, it's like having a thinner and thinner blanket. And as it gets thinner, you get more warmth from that ocean that goes into the atmosphere, and it further warms the atmosphere. So many of us focus on sea ice because it has feedback mechanisms by which it further increases the warming to the planet as sea ice itself diminishes.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Okay, and you and your co-author in that paper in Nature Climate Change, the co-author was Marika M. Holland. You focus on air temperatures over the ocean. You've touched on that already, but why is that important, and what did you find?
Well, we focused on three aspects: sea ice, air temperatures, and rain versus snow days. And one of the reasons we focused on those three is that those are emblematic, if you will, of the Arctic. When you think of the Arctic, it's cold. It's even in the summer, it's colder there than it is at lower latitudes. And it's transitioning to a warmer and more wet, less frozen state. So air temperatures are a part of that. And also that change from rain to snow, which happens because it gets warmer, are a part of that. Air temperature over the Arctic Ocean also become important for weather patterns, in that as the temperatures in the Arctic are warming faster than they are at lower latitudes. So it's getting warmer faster. And as it does so, you decrease this change in temperature from the lower latitudes to the Arctic. You have less of a gradient. It becomes, you just change that temperature difference. And that temperature difference is a driver of the jet stream. So as you change that difference and make the polar is warming faster than the lower latitudes, you end up having, in general, a weaker jet stream. And that has implications for weather patterns at lower latitudes as well as higher latitudes. So many people are very interested in how temperatures in the Arctic are changing as it impacts weather and climate events at lower latitudes.
Yes, a few years ago, Dr. Jennifer Francis at Rutgers came up with paired observations that the reduction of the Arctic sea ice may be linked to dramatic changes to the behavior of the jet stream further south. And I gather that you agree with her theory on that?
I do agree. I don't actually know what the exact changes are, and I do know that how that jet stream is changing is very much an area of active research for the atmospheric scientists who study it. But I do agree that it has implications for the jet stream and for weather patterns.
So we talked about air temperatures over the ocean. I just talked with NCAR distinguished scholar Kevin Trenberth about ocean warming, but we didn't talk about the Arctic Ocean specifically. Do you know what the new Arctic climate will mean for ocean temperatures in the Arctic Ocean itself?
Yes, as you remove sea ice and warm the ocean, it is going to get warmer too. And there are a cascade of things that are going to be impacted by that. Ecosystems, for example, can change because you're going to have a change in ocean temperature, and you may end up with some changes in the ocean circulation as well.
I had seen predictions before that as the world warms, the Arctic will become wetter, but I have to say the prognosis was a bit murky. It's a lot clearer now with your paper, because it sounded like a wetter, greener Arctic would at least be centuries away. What does your new study tell us about what you think is really happening there?
So I think, you know, for many of us at lower latitudes, we often think of climate change as something that's happening in the future. In the Arctic, it's happening now. It's very clear that climate change is here and now, and many of the changes are dramatic. This idea of the Arctic being wetter, we didn't look at actually the amount of water that would be in the Arctic, the amount of rain or the amount of snow. That is highly variable and a little bit trickier to actually look at. But a warmer atmosphere in general can hold more water, and you would anticipate that it's going to be wetter. Whether it comes in more extreme events or wetter throughout the year, I'm not sure. On the other hand, this idea that you might have, when we used to expect snow, we might get rain, and rain might happen earlier and earlier in the year as well as later in the year. So you might have what I call an expansion of the rainy season instead of the snowy season. And that also has great implications in many different ways. For example, early season rain on snow events have been happening in the north, and some of these have had dramatic consequences for caribou, reindeer, and muskox herds, where we've seen herd level die-off starvation due to rain on snow events. Because when you have a really early rain on snow event, oftentimes that rain falls and oftentimes gets colder after that, and it freezes. And it can freeze and make a really thick layer of ice on top of the tundra. And sometimes it's so thick that the caribou, reindeer, and muskox can't actually get through that ice to eat, and they starve. Likewise, if you have rain on permafrost, cold water will melt permafrost much quicker than just cold air, or, you know, warm compared to frozen, you know. So if you have rain on permafrost, you can get permafrost melting, which in turn also can emit methane and greenhouse, which is another greenhouse gas. And it can threaten infrastructure in high latitude places where infrastructure is in the permafrost. Once that permafrost starts melting, you can have many consequences for infrastructure and planning. Likewise, if you change the seasonal cycle of rain versus snow, you change the timing of river runoff, and you change things for anybody who's interested in water management, hydrological managing, and predicting and planning.
There are massive wildfires in the Arctic, in Canada, in Russia, in Alaska. I've been tracking them for years. These are seldom reported. No one tries to put them out. Is it safe to assume that increasing rainfall in the next few decades will reduce Arctic forest fires?
We're starting to get into, I am not familiar with a lot of the science that goes on with forest fires, so I'm going to be a little bit hesitant in my response to that. I would anticipate a change. Now, whether or not the rain, that's going to depend on when the rain falls and how wet things are. But there might indeed be a dramatic impact on that. And I believe that you referred to some work that Mike Flanagan has done. And there are other fire experts. So I don't really know what the consequences are going to be for Arctic wildfires.
Yeah, Mike Flanagan, I sort of asked him a similar question some years ago. And he said, well, look, Alex, it only takes 3 hot, sunny days. And those soils are so thin up there that they can dry out and be ready to burn 3 or 4 days after a big rainfall. So he didn't think that, increased rain would do it. But when I read your paper, again, predicting more rain, but there's a lag between when this Arctic rainfall will increase behind the sea ice extent. And I don't understand why we sort of have to wait a couple of decades to see that, and wait even more decades to see a hotter Arctic.
Yes. Well, we already are seeing a hotter Arctic. It already is hotter. It's just not in many places hot enough to say that, or it hasn't changed so much that you can say it's a new climate. And then we would expect temperatures to follow the sea ice melting. So as that sea ice melts in the summer, the ocean absorbs heat and it releases back into the air in the fall. It's as you, the sea ice has already changed enough statistically it's in a new climate, but the atmosphere is still warming and it just has not changed enough to be declared a new climate. You would expect that fall temperature to start rising after you've melted sea ice. And then in the winter, as the sea ice thins, the air temperature should also warm. And then you kind of have to have the warmer temperatures for the rain versus snow. And rain versus snow is there's a lot of fluctuation in the first day of snow or the first day of rain every year. So the definition of a new climate having to exceed the fluctuations of the past. If you have a larger fluctuation in an aspect, it's going to take a greater change to be able to say, oh, it's in a different climate, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. It makes a lot of sense. So as I mentioned in the introduction, there was a 91 degree Fahrenheit or 32 C recorded at Bathurst Inlet in Canada this summer, and over 90 degrees in Siberia as well. Did the models predict so much heat appearing in the Arctic so soon as 2020?
You know, it's hard to attribute one single place and time to a heat event. And these models, their range of values of possible heat does suggest that it could get that hot. It doesn't necessarily imply that it's predicting it will get that hot that soon, but it does have a range that shows some very, very warm numbers.
One of the big guessing games for Arctic watchers is, in what year will most of the Arctic Ocean be ice-free? They call it a blue ocean event. While I know there's no certainty, would you care to offer an educated guess?
You put me on the record for this. My educated guess, now once again, this is a guess. My educated guess would be by 2040 plus or minus 10 years.
Okay, that gives us a good range. It's not that far away.
No, that's once again, that's a guess. That's not my magic wand that I know what's going to happen, and that's just a guess right now.
Well, yes, and one of the factors, to be clear, your picture of the time it takes for this new Arctic climate to emerge, that forecast is based on the current business-as-usual projections known as RCP 8.5. So if by some miracle we change course, we reduce emissions, we even remove CO2 from the atmosphere, would that prevent the new Arctic climate regime that you are discovering, or would it just delay it for a century or more?
You know, it depends on several things, on how we reduce them and how much we reduce the emissions. Arctic sea ice is already in a new regime. It's already there. On the other hand, temperatures have yet to emerge as being completely different, as well as the rain versus snow events. And there are some studies that suggest that even a change of emissions from the RCP 8.5 scenario, which is the high emissions scenario, to one that is more in line with the Paris Climate Accord, could make significant differences in terms of how likely you are to see an ice-free summer. The differences are somewhat surprising. It could be a difference between whether or not we have the ice in the summers at all by 2100 or whether we don't. And our emissions and how that plays out can play a significant role. So I guess one of the things I like to say is that we still have a choice. We still have some choices here on how this plays out. And although the climate has already changed in the Arctic in many ways, we can slow that change down. We can have an impact on where we get to and how fast we get to it by our emissions. At the same time, the changes in the Arctic are dramatic. They're rapid. They're really easy to see. And now is the time to do those changes. It's not a good time to sit back for another 10 years and watch and see what happens, but to start doing it now.
When I was a kid, any ship could make it across the Arctic Sea from Atlantic to Pacific. If that happened, it was major news in the papers and TV. They needed icebreakers to go along. These days, there are common yachts owned by amateur sailors going from New England to Alaska across the Arctic in summer, and commercial ships are just cruising along the Siberian seas from China to Europe. No icebreakers. That's a stunning change in one lifetime, and now your work suggests this is just the beginning?
It is just the beginning if we don't change emissions.
And Earth has been really hot before. We had fossilized crocodile bones found in an island in the Canadian Arctic, and there were big trees along the Arctic shore in that hothouse world. So it's not necessarily a new thing, but it's the speed of what's happening. That's the big news, isn't it?
Yes, you're exactly right. There have been times when the climate has been even warmer than now. That was before human beings. the speed at which we are changing the climate is dramatic.
And if the sea ice disappears, that cuts the time and cost for international shipping, and it provides new economic opportunities, perhaps, or places for people to live. Laura Landrum, maybe a new Arctic climate is a good thing.
You know, change is always, you know, there might be some good and there might be some bad in that. The changes that are happening now are certainly putting on, adding to some stress and difficulties for Arctic communities that already are living in the Arctic. Some of them are having to relocate because of coastal erosion. Access to food is changing for those that are subsistence communities. And yes, you are right. It will have new shipping opportunities as well as resource exploration opportunities. Along with that also comes risk. You know, for example, with the new increase in shipping, and there's been a dramatic increase in cruise traffic in the Arctic, and one of the nightmare scenarios for an oil spill response team is having a ship have an accident of some sort in a pristine estuary that has not been exposed, and that is really hard to get to and clean up, and that's kind of a nightmare scenario for a possible oil spill. So there's, you know, it's hard to say black and white, good and bad. There's lots of changes. There's also going to be the rate at which we are changing things makes it very difficult for species to respond. and to change and to adapt. And there's going to be a lot of losses if we don't change.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is American scientist Laura Landrum, and we are talking about the new Arctic. It's not every day a scientist like yourself can announce a new Arctic climate. Have you had pushback or agreement from other scientists? And what do you hope will come out of this?
I think the results in this paper are not necessarily surprising in some ways. It's one of the first ones that has done it from different aspects, and also that we had a lot of model data available to do it. There have been many other studies that have looked at one aspect at a time that have been suggesting the same thing, that the Arctic is changing to a new climate. This one, in many ways, validates what some individual ones have done and in a slightly a different way. So it also validates what a lot of people who are living in the Arctic are experiencing. I don't think you'd find anybody who's living in the Arctic who would say that they would expect the sea ice conditions this year to resemble those of the 80s. Yet they've been living with it, and they know it's different. And this confirms it.
And there have been a few political conferences and some weak agreements about governing the Arctic in a time of change. I wonder if the urgency of the new Arctic climate found in your research will reach other institutions and world leaders. What do you think?
I don't know. I like to think that many of those that actually working and living in the Arctic have known that it's changing and needs to be addressed immediately. I do believe that this story is an important and a timely one, and that it deserves a wider audience. So not just the people in the Arctic, but for everybody at all latitudes, that changing Arctic, it's a changing climate, and it's a little bit of the canary in the gold mine. It is the rest of the world's climate is also changing, although in some places it might not be as dramatic and visible as it is in the Arctic right now. And we can use those changes that we see in the Arctic as motivation to change.
Laura, what are you working on now, and what are some of the known unknowns that Arctic specialists need to tackle?
Well, I have a project right now that I'm looking at the influence of the thickness of the sea ice on warming, particularly in the winter temperatures. And we know a lot about how the conduction of heat from the ocean to the atmosphere occurs depending on the thickness or thinness of ice. And I'm exploring, like, how does that influence, how are our estimates for future warming, and how does the, based on sea ice thickness, if we know more about that, how can we further refine our estimates for how the Arctic might warm based on sea ice thickness? And I'm also involved in another project that's looking at snow and snow on sea ice. Snow is even more reflective than sea ice, and it's hard to measure snow depths across the Arctic and to actually get snow versus ice. And we are actively working on research to better understand snow on sea ice. And I also work in the Antarctic. I'm a polar scientist, so I also have Antarctic work. And one of the projects I'm working on that I'm very excited about in the Antarctic is I'm teaming up with ecologists and seabird and predator ecologists to understand interactions between sea ice and ecology.
Yes, it's interesting. I spoke with another scientist who explained that although, strangely, the Antarctic sea ice was expanding for many years, I think it was around 2017, 2018, it crashed, and it crashed even faster and further than the Arctic sea ice had done.
Yes, 2016, I believe, was when the Antarctic sea ice dramatically decreased. And the Antarctic sea ice is very different in terms of what contains it. If the Arctic is an ocean, an open ocean surrounded by land, in the winter, that sea ice cannot expand beyond those land boundaries. So it has kind of a maximum perimeter on it. In the Antarctic, on the other hand, the sea ice, almost all of it, not all of it, but most of it actually melts in the summer, and it grows as an incredible annual cycle of growth and decay. And the boundary is not held by land. It's by water, the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. But it grows it expands and it melts almost all the way back to the continent in most locations around Antarctic. So they're very different systems. Even though they're both sea ice, they have very different things going on.
As we near the end of our time together, Laura, do you have other thoughts you would like to leave with our listening audience?
I would like to stress once again that the Arctic, the changes that are going on, that are being experienced right now and are part of climate change, we can change how this plays out. We can change how it's going to take global collaboration and working together to change our emissions on this planet. I do believe that we can do it, and I think the time to do that is now. It's not time to wait, but it's now. But we do have an opportunity here to change how this plays out.
From the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado, we've been speaking to Arctic scientist Laura Landrum. Well, I should say polar scientist. You can find links to press reports and her new study in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Laura, thank you for telling us about this new climate emerging on planet Earth.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for the opportunity to help tell this story.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.
Now, a plaque has been unveiled in Iceland to remember the first of its 400 glaciers to be lost to climate change. Ökjökull glacier used to cover 15 square kilometres of mountainside. Now it is barely 1 square kilometre and less than 15 metres deep. It was officially declared dead back in 2014, but now we have this memorial, which bears the inscription, "A Letter to the Future," warning that all of Iceland's glaciers are expected to disappear in the next 200 years.
Ok is the first Icelandic glacier to lose its status as a glacier. In the next 200 years, all our glaciers are expected to follow the same path. This monument is to acknowledge that we know what is happening and what needs to be done.
Only you know if we did it.
An interesting thing is that the melt season actually in Greenland started pretty much end of April, beginning of May, which in the grand scheme of things is very close to a month earlier than average.
The latest science, published August 31st in the prestigious journal Nature, says ice loss is beyond the worst-case scenario used by models and the Intergovernmental Panels on Climate Change. The study, Ice Sheet Losses Track High-End Sea Level Rise Projections, was led by Dr. Thomas Slater, a research fellow at the University of Leeds. Thomas works in the Center for Polar Observation and Modeling. From the UK, Tom Slater, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're trying to look forward in time here to see what the force of rising seas will do. And for me, one of the clearest examples comes with those high storm surges, like the dramatic flooding of Lower Manhattan during Hurricane Sandy in October 2012. Thomas, are we already at a point where polar ice loss is helping to bring more intense disasters?
Yes, exactly right. Sometimes people, when they think of sea level rise, they think of land being inundated by seawater, but you're right in that the immediate risk and the effects that we are seeing now is due to the storm surge flooding. The sea level is now rising at a rate of about 4 millimeters per year. It's only going to increase, and we are going to see the increased effects of an increased likelihood of storm surge flooding along our coastlines.
We know water expands as it heats up, and just, it seems like a decade or two ago, we were told that the largest contributor to global sea level rise was thermal expansion. Has melting ice overtaken that to become the number one driver? And if so, when did that happen?
That's happened very recently, so certainly up until the past decade or so, thermal expansion has been the main contributor to sea level rise. But now we find the cryosphere, so that's Antarctica and Greenland and mountain glaciers, and now contribute for most of sea level rise. And of these components, the ice sheets are losing ice at a fastest rate. So we expect over the course of this century that the ice sheets will become an increasingly large contributor of sea level rise, to the point where they will be the largest contributor to sea level rise by the end of the century.
Let's talk about your new paper. What did your team set to find out?
So over the past three decades, thanks to satellite missions launched by the European Space Agency and NASA, we have a long-term continuous record of ice losses. And satellites are really the only way that we can measure ice loss, both continuously and at the continent level, because Antarctica and Greenland are so huge and so far away. It's just impossible to measure this ourselves on foot, so we have to rely on satellites. And at the same time, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they estimate ice losses both historically and in the future. And we are now at a point where there is 10 years of overlap between these two time series. So it's a good exercise to compare the two, and that tells us both where we are in terms of what we should expect the sea level rise this century, but it also tells us how well we're doing in terms of describing ice sheets in our models and how we can improve those as well.
Ice melts in two basic ways, really. It may become water that evaporates from the surface, or ice can fall into the sea. How much ice is lost to simple evaporation compared to what is flowing into the ocean?
So it's not just evaporation, it's also surface melting. So the ice sheet contribution, you're right, ice sheet contribution to the rise comes from two processes. One is we call the surface mass balance, and that's essentially how much snow has fallen on an ice sheet versus how much has been lost from the surface. So that is through evaporation, but largely, particularly in Greenland, we see it through the melting. In the summer in Greenland, it gets hot enough to melt, and that meltwater will run off into the ocean. And it also loses ice through ice dynamic, which is, as you say, the calving of icebergs, and also ocean-driven melting under the surface. And in Antarctica, we find that pretty much all of the ice loss is through this ice dynamical process. In certain regions of Antarctica, the ocean has warmed considerably, and that melts these ice shells, so where the ice is floating on the sea from underneath, and these ice shells are holding back the ice inland. And that causes that to flow faster and out into the ocean. In Greenland, what we've seen is actually about 50-50 ice losses from both ice flow and from this melting. But only in the past decade or so has melting in Greenland really started to ramp up. And it varies significantly from year to year as well. So last year was a large melt year in Greenland, and 2012 was as well. And we've seen that there's these high-pressure weather patterns that can persist over the ice sheet and induce melting across nearly all of the surface area. So particularly in 2012, almost all of the surface area was melting in the period of about a few days or so.
That's what got me wondering about evaporation. I've been looking at some videos and some photos showing the surface of Greenland, and there's these beautiful blue lakes, I would call them, ponds at least, forming all across the surface. And I thought, well, some of that has to be going up into the atmosphere instead of pouring directly into the ocean. But is evaporation a factor or not?
Nearly all of it will run off into the ocean.
You know, melting on the Greenland ice sheet can speed up or slow down, but it only has one direction, really negative. It's always losing ice, and by giant amounts. But the increase did slow down in 2017 and 2018. Tom, why did that happen?
It's true that the rate of ice loss has slowed down in 2017 and 2018, and that is largely controlled by Greenland. Like I said before, that ice loss in Greenland is about half ice flow and half melting on the surface, and this amount of melting is largely influenced by the weather. So 2017 and 2018 were particularly cool years in Greenland, and so there was less melting in the summer. This is not the case for Antarctica. Antarctica is always, ice losses in Antarctica are increasing, and because it doesn't get warm enough to melt on the surface, and all the ice losses are caused by ice flow. Even still, while 2000 and 2018 may have been slower years in terms of ice loss, in the context of the past few years, if you look at the long-term record of ice losses, so if we go back the past few decades, then they are still high ice loss years.
And tell us about the amount of ice melt in Greenland in 2019.
And so 2019 was another significant year in Greenland. I think it's on track to be the second highest, or was the second highest year for ice losses in the past decade. And the highest was 2012, and that's because the summer was particularly warm, and it induced lots of surface melting, which then ran off into the ocean.
Do we have any early indications of the state of the Greenland ice for this year, 2020?
There's still reports coming in, from what I've seen, is that it hasn't been as warm as it has last year in the summer. So I think there has been less surface melt. And there's also been some instances of large amounts of snowfall. So I think that this year will be a lower ice loss year compared to last year, but it will still be high because it's not just the surface melt. As we've spoken about, ice flow into the ocean from Greenland is increasing because the ocean is warm there as well. We can only expect that these high melt years, they're not happening every year at the moment, but as the atmosphere warms and continues to warm, then the likelihood is that every year will be a high melt year in Greenland, you know, over the coming decades.
Well, there have been some crazy high heat records in the Arctic this year. I don't know if they hit Greenland, but I know that Bathurst Inlet in Canada hit 91 degrees Fahrenheit just a week or so ago, and that's crazy. That's just never been heard of up there. And, of course, we know Siberia was hot, 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 just amazing. Did that heat get to Greenland as well? Do you know?
So Greenland is somewhat tends to stay cooler because obviously it's a huge area of land that's covered in ice. So towards the margins, it does get hot, and there are instances of, you know, rainfall in like March and April over the past couple of years. But also it doesn't need to get to such high temperatures. It just needs to get above zero, and we're finding that that's consistently happening in the summer.
There's been a raft of papers about Greenland this summer, and most of the media focus is on Greenland. When does ice loss from Antarctica really kick in, and can we assume that Antarctic ice won't overtake that Greenland contribution in the next century or two? Do we know that?
So I think in the cases of both ice sheets, that these ice losses have really kicked in the past few decades or so. In terms of Antarctica, so even though Greenland is a smaller ice sheet, it holds much less ice than Antarctica. So if all of the ice in Greenland to melt, I mean, this is a scenario that would play out in thousands of years. So it would take for all the ice sheets to melt. But Greenland has about 7 meters sea level rise potential, and Antarctica has 58 meters of sea level rise potential. So that's a real concern. But even still, Greenland is losing more ice than Antarctica. It accounts for about 60% of the current sea level contribution. But what we've seen in Antarctica is that there are huge glaciers that are potentially unstable. They're in a configuration where there is the potential for the ice loss to become irreversible and progressive due to the way that their bedrock is configured. So this is the rock that the ice lies upon. If it slopes in a retrograde fashion, so if it slopes downwards and further you go inland, once the ocean gets in past a certain point, then the melting will be continuous. So to answer your question, yes, there is a potential for Antarctica to overtake Greenland.
In 2019, you co-authored a paper on trends in the mass and size of Antarctic's ice store. It is not a simple picture. Could you explain how one part of the southern continent can be gaining more ice while another part is losing it?
Antarctica, we like to split it up into three distinct geographical regions. So there's Antarctic Peninsula, there's the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, and there's the East Antarctic Ice Sheet. And as you said, most of the ice loss in Antarctica is coming from this Western Antarctic Ice Sheet. And it's all due to which climate factors it's exposed to. So here in this West Antarctic region, this is where the ocean has warmed significantly. And this is eroding glaciers away from underneath and causing them to flow faster. And we've seen modest gains, so in the East Antarctic Ice Sheet, but it's much, much larger than the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. And also, most of it is above sea level, so less of it is exposed to the ocean. But gains due to snowfall in the East Antarctic Ice Sheet are still not enough to offset the losses elsewhere, so Antarctica is still losing ice. And there are also glaciers in the East Antarctic Ice Sheet that we've noticed over the past few years have begun to speed up. So it's not always the case that this sector of Antarctica will gain ice in the future.
Several scientists object to using the term tipping point for what's happening with ice loss on Greenland. The authors of the paper published August 13th in Nature did not use the phrase tipping point at all, but some media have done so. And I've seen some articles about your paper saying we've crossed the point of no return. What do you think about tipping point and Greenland?
I think it's a really complex argument that is difficult to communicate. I think for the paper you're referring to, I think it's all a question of how you define a tipping point. I think the paper that you're referring to there, I think what the authors were trying to communicate was more that Greenland has entered a new regime where it's more considerably more likely to lose ice in any given year than it has gained. So if we look at Greenland 30 years ago, there are years when the more snow will have fallen than will have been lost. So I think that's what the authors were trying to communicate there. We spoke about tipping points previously in Antarctica when I talked about this marine ice sheet instability.
I know what you're talking about in Antarctica, where NASA declared, I think it was the Thwaites Glacier was one of them, that the progress of it was unstoppable now, as you mentioned, partly because of the geology below the glacier. But to take such a gigantic mass of ice like Greenland and say, well, it's reached a tipping point, I think some of the scientists who study Greenland have objected to that, saying, well, it's just not that simple, and there's a very much larger progression at work here.
Yeah, I would fully agree with that.
So in 2014, Icelandic experts declared the Auk Glacier dead, the first to be killed off by climate change. There's now a plaque at the former glacier with a letter to the future there. But when I look at photos, there's still snow and ice there. So experts seem to have a different definition of what dead means when they're talking about glaciers. What does a glaciologist mean by dead?
I think it means to the point where the loss is irreversible. So I guess maybe this links into our discussion about tipping points. And I think for the case of this glacier, then the atmosphere is warmed so much that it will only melt away and it cannot recover the ice through snowfall, because each year it's just going to lose more through melting.
Well, that's true. And the letter to the future does say that over the next 200 years, they expect all of Iceland's glaciers to be dead. But also there's the concept that it takes a certain amount of ice mass to make a glacier move. And once it loses that mass, it just becomes static and sits there. It's no longer living in the sense of moving. And I think that is also part of the dead definition that they gave for the Icelandic glacier.
Okay, yeah.
So fearing a loss of glaciers and sea ice in an Arctic that's warming far faster than anywhere else, some scientists suggest we need to reduce the sun with geoengineering, specifically sulfate particles launched into the stratosphere over the Arctic. And two cooler summers in Greenland, as you mentioned, did show a direct reduced loss of the rate of ice, anyway, from Greenland. So I wonder, could engineering slow down the loss and thus dramatically change the possibilities considered in your new paper?
I mean, I would preface this by saying I'm not an expert in geoengineering in any way. I would say that we should focus more on reducing emissions. That's one way we can reduce warming, and then therefore we can reduce the likelihood of seeing ice melting in line with these worst case scenarios. And I think that's the more immediate and pressing thing that we should focus on.
On August 8th, the famous director of the Swiss Federal Institute for Forest, Snow and Landscape Research fell into an unexpected crevasse near his base camp, where he died. And surely the passing of Dr. Konrad Steffen at his work in Greenland comes as a shock to everyone studying melt at the poles. So what did you think?
I didn't know Dr. Konrad Steffen personally, but I was familiar with his work. And his death was a shock and a great loss to all of us.
Yeah, he was a giant in his field, really. Now, in your new paper in Nature, you discuss, quote, gauging the likelihood of extreme sea level rise from marine ice sheet and ice cliff instabilities, end quote. What are you talking about, and what do scientists mean by extreme sea level rise?
So the marine ice sheet instability is what we talked about earlier, and the effects of the slope of the bedrock on the ice loss. The ice cliff instability is a theoretical scenario where if you have ice cliffs above a certain height, about 100 meters or so, and these are unstable and can fracture and collapse, and that would instigate huge amounts of ice loss. I would preface this, that this behavior has never been observed in Antarctica. So the likelihood of it is still being debated in the community. But by extreme sea level rise, we're talking about contributions of beyond a meter by the end of the century. And these are the mechanisms in which that would happen. But in terms of narrowing down how likely these scenarios are to happen is something we're still actively working on.
So what's at stake here as we try to guess how much sea level will go up? I mean, suppose it is a meter by the end of the century or even a bit more. Do we know the economic and human costs at risk from rising seas as we heat up this planet?
Yeah, we have a very good idea. A lot of our major cities and economic infrastructure and, millions of people live on the coast. They are already a threat to storm surges, as we've seen in New York. And it's our job to, one, try to curb emissions so we can reduce the likelihood of extreme sea level rise in the future. And two, to plan and build appropriate coastal defences to protect these people and the infrastructure. And the time we need to start doing that is now, because we've delayed for so long. We're trying to say here that we should be expecting more sea level rise than we're currently expecting. We should be expecting it to happen sooner. So we need to step up our coastal defences.
Yes, how well do predictions by models and the assessment reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, how well do they closely match the direct observations of ice status from scientists on the glaciers and from satellites?
The picture is different for both ice sheets and both the ice loss mechanisms we've spoken about, so the surface mass balance and the ice dynamics. We found for both Antarctica and Greenland that they're tracking the worst case scenarios. And the reason we're not capturing this behavior in the models is different for both ice sheets. So in Greenland, as we talk about these high pressure weather patterns that are causing these high melt years, they're difficult to describe in models and haven't been well described or fully described in the past. In Antarctica, where the ocean is melting the ice sheet from underneath, we just have gaps in our knowledge in about these processes, because these are really difficult places to access and gain measurements. So we have very little observations of ice melting underneath, in situ observations. And that feeds into our models as well.
I think they just sent a drone underneath one of those Antarctic glaciers to try and determine what you're talking about, what is going on under there.
Yeah, and that's exactly the sort of, experiments and expeditions we need to improve our models and help inform us how much sea level rise to expect.
Tom Slater, what are you working on now?
We've still got to monitor the ice sheet, use the satellite to do that. I think now our next focus is these satellite missions. They take decades to plan. The satellites that are up in the air now will have been first conceived, 20, 30 years ago. So we need to look forward to the next set of missions in terms of what we have available to us now. There is no direct planned successor for a polar mission from either space agency. So that's our focus, because if we lose these observations, then we're in danger of having a very real gap in our knowledge. And it will be difficult to go back to that scenario. We've had continuous measurements 30 years now. We've only had a few dedicated polar missions, and to not have a dedicated polar mission would make it more difficult to understand what's happening to the ice sheets and then inform our modelling activities.
Well, perhaps Elon Musk will step in and provide the satellite that's needed.
I think it would be better if it was our publicly funded space agency.
I agree. From the University of Leeds in the UK, we've been speaking with research specialist Dr. Thomas Slater. He is lead author of the new paper, Ice Sheet Losses Track High-End Sea Level Rise Projections. That was published in the journal Nature at the end of August, and you can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tom Slater, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. Take care.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
These polar changes are taking all life into a new age. Driving it all, Earth is retaining more energy from the sun, trapped by greenhouse gases, from our tailpipes and smokestacks. It's that simple. Living things experience the changes in many ways, but the key is heat. You can find my new book, Surviving the Age of Extreme Heat, at my website, ecoshock.org. This ebook brings key interviews from Radio EcoShock from 16 top scientists and physicians, plus authors and activists. It's over 150 pages of transcripts, plus my comments, with tons of live links to check the facts or find out more. I appreciate every one of you listening and passing on the word about this show. Please tell everyone you know about Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.